since I started doing this stuff in 2018, because of you, right? So I think I want everybody, including members of your family, I hope are really clear that like you, you're responsible for all this, right? I mean,
I met
bad,
you and you're a waitress at a cocktail bar.
Exactly. Anything bad that Ben does is ultimately Doug's fault, right?
I know. That's right. And I'm proud to take on that responsibility, so, Ben.
But yeah.
Utter confidence in you. We're going to shift over to the Patreon part of our conversation, and maybe we can pick this up and talk about this. And we've been kind of doing this all along, but a little bit more personal or practical immediate terms, like what are we doing in our own projects that we think might have some might need to change or might need to stay the same, or like what, how do I evaluate what I've been doing since I started at zero books to now, and how do you evaluate what you've been doing? Because again, like I said at the beginning, I do feel as though I'm at a bit of an impasse and maybe need to rethink what I was doing in order to get to the next stage. So we'll start with the Patreon part of this.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Diet Soap is a Sublation Media podcast. All right. So Ben Burgess is back on the Diet Soap podcast. Thank you, Ben, for visiting. When I was in New York City, I was informed by many about how successful and important you have become. So I am always grateful that you're here. And I do want to remind you, I think I say this too often, it's an old joke now, that when I met you, you were a waitress in a cocktail bar. And
that's right.
And now you're a big star.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I had somebody in New York tell me something even weirder, you know, that I was just talking to this random person and they started telling me how they were a C. Derek Varnes super fan. So, you know, that's got to be even more disconcerting.
You know what? I'm going to edit that out. I don't want that in. Okay. So I wanted to talk to you today. But just because in a way you're like Tony Randall on Letterman. It's like, oh, I don't have a guest lined up. I'm going to break the glass and bring out the emergency guest. Don't feel offended. That is a compliment because you are so reliable as a guest. But I also, I don't know, I've been feeling a little discouraged lately overall about the left and about my own project. I mean, I don't feel like Sublation is doing badly. But I do feel as though we're a little more rudderless than I would want. Like when I started podcasting, I kind of knew what I was trying to figure out. And now I don't even know quite what I'm trying to figure out anymore. Like it just seems things are up in the air. The way I put it together in my head was that when Trump was elected, the biggest fear that people had on the left was that there would be some rising right-wing movement that would roll back civil liberties and that would create more inequality in society and undo some of the progress that we'd seen. And now, after Trump is gone, so at least for the moment, and we have a Democratic administration and government, it seems as though the problems we're facing are more existential than that. Even though some of the things that we worried about have happened, like the overturning of Roe versus Wade, for example, it seems as though the way we handled ourselves from, I don't know, 2008 on, or certainly from 2016 on, has created conditions where a great many things seem very precarious, primarily Ukraine. There's been talk of a conflict between the United States and China and the United States and Russia mm-hmm. for a long time, certainly since 2014 with Russia and and just as China has become a powerhouse economically, there's been talk about that. But now suddenly what was sort of like paranoid fears have become practical concerns. And I don't feel quite up to the task of being a socialist during a time when there could be a true possibility of global war. how are you handling it?
Yeah, try not to think about it. I guess I'm like, I am definitely worried about the second thing you said, but I'm still pretty worried about the first one, right? So in other words, I do think that the sort of Trumpified Republican Party is very bad news in some ways that overlap with what you were kind of describing when you were talking about fears that people had a while ago. Mm-hmm. I think it's, I wouldn't claim to have a crystal ball. I mean, clearly I would be the first to admit, like I didn't think Trump was going to win in 2016. Right. Mm-hmm. I've been wrong about tons of shit like that. Right. But, so I could be wrong about this, which would be nice. I'd like to be, but, it feels to me very much like, either Trump is coming back in 2024, or it's going to be like some ghoul who's like a competent Trump, like some like Ron DeSantis figure. And maybe that's wrong, right? Maybe it won't happen. Stranger things have happened. But like right now, it seems like Biden has been just unspeakably, miserably like inept. And it's been, it's really hard to say, like, other than, whether like sort of fear of Trump is going to be enough to sort of get him over the finish line again, right? He barely won in 2020 when it was easier to vote than it has ever been before. Right. And mm-hmm. certainly easier to vote than it will be in 2024. And I do think that would be like that Trump part two or DeSantis part one or whatever. I do think that would be really bad. Right. And I don't think it would necessarily be bad in like some of the most like dramatic ways that people on the left sometimes say. Right. Like, I don't think I never thought that like, there was some scenario where like the January 6th rioters, overthrew bourgeois democracy and we were just going to have a fascist dictatorship or something. Right. I was mm-hmm. never worried about that. Right. But I do think that, some of what you're saying about civil liberties and progress and all that stuff, like, I don't think it's going to be dramatic, but I do think that there are definitely ways that the United States could become an even less democratic country than it already is. Right. I mean, like, if you sort of think about the spectrum of capitalist democracies, right, we're already not starting at a great point of that spectrum. And I think it could get a lot worse. Right. I think there are a lot of signs. If you look at what like Republican state legislatures around the country have done, I think there are a lot of signs about how it could get worse. What have they been, doing with themselves, right? I mean, there have been all sorts of, they're the anti, so-called anti-critical race theory laws. There's the, what I think is actually accurately referred to as don't say gay in Florida. There are laws that like make it easier to get away with running over a protester with your car, and so I think a lot of that, I got the celebrities front. Like, I think if the next couple of elections go the way that it unfortunately feels like they might, I think things could get way worse. And then in combination with, with just the sort of standard economic cruelty that you'd expect for those people, and like a lot of, and I do think that there's a certain way that the Republican base has gotten energized in a really ugly way in terms of, like, you know, trans people and the panic about grooming and all of that stuff, right? So I think all that could be really bad, but World War III would be even worse. That's
well, yeah. But let's unpack some of the things you just said, because I found myself, well, when it comes to DeSantis, I don't really know, right? I've not been paying close enough attention. But I always have felt that Trump was sui generis. Is that how you say it? Like, he was unique. That no other Republican, no matter what policies they took on, could quite be like Trump. Because Trump was, well, he came out of the real estate industry, and also out of the entertainment industry. But also, he just seemed to be so clearly narcissistically driven, and in that way, more of a, it built more of a cult of personality around him than any other Republican I see on the stage being able to do. He was also a weird mix of kind of left and right impulses. Mm-hmm. People would say that he was like, people from the Platypus Affiliated Society would say, well, he was a peace candidate. Mm-hmm. And in a way he was, because he would say things like that the war in Iraq was a disaster, that he was critical of the Bush administration in a way no other Republican could have been, and not even very many Democrats quite were.
It is worth noting that, I mean, I know you said candidate, you know, but like as president, I think by any reasonable standards, right, the Joe Biden has been, you know, I mean, like, whatever, where the curve that we have to grade on for U.S. presidents is absolutely insane, right? Because I think Biden has like committed some like real crimes against humanity, actually. But relative, you know, graded on that curve, right? I mean, Biden has actually been way more of a peace guy as president than Trump was. I mean, Biden actually ripped off the Band-Aid in Afghanistan, which shocked me, and stuck to it, you know, even when the press was crucifying for it. You know, I mean, he also froze funds in a way that, again, I really do think is a crime against humanity. But I mean, like, as far as like U.S. military engagement, I mean, ending the forever war in Afghanistan is huge. And if you look at the numbers of airstrikes, like he's actually almost completely ended the drone war. I mean, there's like barely anything going on, you know, compared to what was going on under either Trump or Obama. And I'm not entirely sure why that is, right? But it is, I think, just an interesting thing worth throwing in there, right? Just because I think that, like, a lot of people, I don't think it really fits with any of the usual narratives that anybody has about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, when
also,
it comes to
also, our... he didn't do a no-fly zone in Ukraine. I kind of think that.
Oh my God! Well, I mean,
I kind of think that like, if like Pete Buttigieg was president, he probably would have done the no-fly zone.
You think? I don't know. I there was no one in the military who was advising that. There was like
I don't know.
Maybe, deep state, you know, and the Defense Department did not want to see that happen.
Okay, well, I hope you're right, but I mean, I just have, but like there was, you know, when there was all this public pressure to do that, right? I mean, like that's. I mean, and this is also, by the way, where the Trump comparison gets really hard, because like, I honestly have no fucking idea what Donald Trump would have done if he were president when all this happened. I think.
Right. It's impossible to say. Right.
I think the range of options go all the way from Trump.
Nuke Moscow.
It goes from nuke Moscow on one end to like make some sort of deal with Putin and head off the invasion on the other end. And I have absolutely no, I think it's actually in principle unknowable what Trump would have done.
So was it Obama who really saw us through the ending of the occupation of Iraq, or was it Trump? Do you remember? I think it was a slow process, but I remember it being
Obama. I think that the, I think that that technically, well, hold on. I think, because it's weird and complicated, because like, I think there were a bunch of different announcements that it was over, and that oftentimes if you looked at the fine print, you know, it like wasn't,
it wasn't
over.
Yeah.
Right. So,
right.
So I'm not,
I think the last one was under Trump, but the first big one was under Obama, right?
Yeah. Cause there was the, there was, it was under Obama that like, there was an attempt to negotiate keeping some residual troops in Iraq that like fell through. Right. And so I think there was at least a minute where like there were probably still like drones and like a few things, but like more or less U.S. military presence in Iraq was gone. But then I think some of it came back a little bit because of the war against ISIS.
Right. But when Obama, what I recall, and yeah, and you know what, I will check into this and maybe do a fact check at the beginning of the, when this is released, but
yeah,
when Obama started the withdrawal of troops from Iraq, he got a lot of credit for that,
yeah,
but he had done it on the timetable that the Bush administration agreed to. And that for all of it, for Iraq and Afghanistan, both, the fact that it eventually ended hardly counts to me as some great victory for any kind of peace movement or a peace candidate or.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I pretty much agree with you. The one thing I would just say, though, is that, like, I do think in the Afghanistan case specifically, I do think that, like, even though Trump negotiated the framework, I don't think, I think it's kind of not a coincidence that the timing was such that it wouldn't actually kick in until later. And I think there's at the very least an open question about whether he would have been able to bring himself to rip off the Band-Aid completely at the end, especially under the circumstances of, like, you know, I mean, actually it's kind of half forgotten now, which is good, you know, but like at the time that it was happening, right. I mean, that they like really like, Biden was just being like absolutely murdered in the press, and you know,
I know there was across the political spectrum, people were very critical of Biden and the way in which that was done, and it looked like a defeat for everybody when it happened. I mean, I remember images of Afghan army, you know, people, soldiers, I believe, or police, or someone, some people within the bureaucracy trying to exit with the U.S. forces and like grabbing onto the helicopter and then being dropped, you know, to their death. They're like, that's on film or something like that, because it was just like a disaster in the way that they exited.
I think it probably, my sense, I mean, I know that there's a, I know that not everybody believes this. I know there's an argument about the fighting season or whatever, although honestly, I think there are times in the past the Taliban has been willing to fight outside of that, right? You know, when they needed to. But like, I don't know. I mean, without claiming to have any sort of like granular expertise about, you know, military strategy and all that, which, by the way, none of the people who are mad at Biden had either. But my sense is that it was always going to end like that, that the only way realistically that it wasn't would be if Biden had done the even more unpopular thing and just basically done a negotiated surrender to the Taliban, you know, to so it could get out in an orderly way. Because like otherwise, you know, I mean, the whole thing is that this government we've been propping up, I mean, didn't have enough of a base of support to last like a second, you know, without U.S. troops backing it up. So, I mean, it collapsed before we could even get everybody out, which, you know, I mean, whatever else you want to say about it, I mean, it really does underline how just like tragically, amazingly pointless the previous 20 years were.
Yeah. And so back to Trump as a supposed peace candidate, one of the things that would cut against that for me completely would be, one, the, extrajudicial assassination of an Iraqi political leader, you know, the way in which he violated all norms, and, you know, like that. Also, the arming of Ukraine during that time obviously set up the conflict that we have now, that is happening in Ukraine. I believe that arming Ukraine helped to lead to the eventual invasion.
Yeah, and I think it's a really important point that, again, I think it kind of screws with everybody's narratives about this on various sides, you know, that that like during the Obama years, one of the big like Republican talking points about like what a terrible cuck Obama was that he wasn't willing to send heavy weaponry to right. Ukraine, and Trump mm-hmm. was.
Right. And I think that's because Trump just was listening to what's sometimes called the blob or the Washington consensus more than Obama did, although Obama did as well, and certainly Biden has. And yeah, it screws with everyone's narrative because it's not very clear. Like, I believe that the that Hillary Clinton, if she had been elected, would have armed Ukraine as well. I mean, I just mm-hmm. I can't justify that belief with any
no, but I mean that does seem right, right? I mean, that's I mean, you're probably right that this is what I said about Buttigieg is wrong for the reason you said, but like I just like all of these sort of like weird lab grown Democrats like Hillary and Buttigieg and all these people, like I just have this like I you know, just on a sort of dumb intuitive level, there's probably no reason I think this is true, right? Like, but I just feel like, yeah, they would have like gone to the brink and done whatever so that people didn't think they were weak.
Right. Yeah, that might be. There are these kind of, you know, particular kind of contingent factors involved in these decisions, but
I think that it's entirely possible that neither of us would have ever existed if JFK had been assassinated a few years earlier and like LBJ had been president during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Because if you read I'm blanking on the guy's name. I read all three of those books, but the Master of the Senate, that guy, those books about LBJ, you know, LBJ, and you read the parts about his reaction to the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, like his role in those meetings was be like, no, man, we need to show them that we're tough, you know, like go in and like, you know, we need to like go in and like start shooting at the, you know, at the like, you know, Russian missile installations in Cuba.
Right.
And so it's like, I don't know. I mean, I always think about.
But also that one Russian submarine commander.
Yeah.
Had never been born, we would all be gone too, right? You know, like, yeah, there are these moments that are just particular and contingent. But I also feel like if you focus on those, it leads you to kind of political impotence because you don't know. You can't, that's a level you can't do fucking anything, right? I mean, maybe you can if it's a matter of like who's president, but you certainly can't if it's like who's in that Russian submarine. And they seem to be equally important at times, right? Maybe this is not justifiable, but I try to think about the overall like trends rather than specific administrations. Like I would not blame the Bush administration for the economic crisis of 2008, despite how much I disliked the Bush administration, right?
But probably if Al Gore had, he was elected, but if Al Gore had become president, nothing would have been different.
Right. I mean, there may have been things that would have been different. Perhaps we would not have gone into, I mean, it could have been.
Oh, yeah. To be clear, nothing would have been different about the subprime lending, the housing.
But, you know, right. Yeah. But I mean, like it's conceivable that September 11th wouldn't have happened. If it hadn't been.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that's really hard to know.
Right. Well, there's all these warnings and intelligence briefings and how you react.
No, I remember all of the old like John Stewart bit on the Daily Show where he was he was going through he started with the real and then went into the parody briefings, you know, as the Bin Laden determined to attack within the United States. No really dumbass Bin Laden determined to attack within the United States. So it's you know, maybe, right? I mean, it's like, I don't know. I mean, I can remember, I can certainly remember that long ago, beautiful time when I was in my early 20s and I was convinced that you know, a slightly less incompetent version of the Bush administration would have stopped it. Is that actually true? I have no idea. It might be.
Yeah. But the major thing that I am trying to grapple with right now is given, who I am, this is how I'm thinking, really, because it has to do with my age and where I grew up. I was born in 1970. I remember the Reagan administration and the warmongering and saber rattling that went on during his administration pretty vividly. I grew up near NORAD, right under, in the shadow of NORAD. the fear of nuclear destruction, nuclear Armageddon, was baked into me pretty early on. Like by the time I was 11, I was anti-nuke all the way, and it dominated my thoughts, nightmares, and all that. And so now I think about the conflict in Ukraine in the context of mutual assured destruction, in the context of remembering the fears that I had back then and that we all had in the 80s and certainly earlier in the 60s. I mean, I can't imagine what it would have been like to actually live through the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I also feel as though in the 80s and perhaps the 60s, there was a left that really was very concerned about nuclear destruction, nuclear Armageddon, that was trying to organize disarmament and for peace. And now, risking global conflict and nuclear war is one of, not the only, left positions that we have on the table. And that is different.
Yeah, for
than
sure.
I experienced in the past.
Yeah. I mean, I think our friend Jean Bajelon has a good line on some of this stuff, which, I don't remember which of us said this, but I had a good conversation about this where it's like I think in some ways what you're saying over Ukraine, and it probably would have happened over other things, but this a weird dramatic version of it is this split between two very different groups of people who were sort of thrown together in kind of 2015 to 2020, which very roughly the way I like to think about it is there's the kind of Bernie voter who reads Jacobin, and then there's the kind of Bernie voter who's Bernie 2016 sticker was right next to their Obama 2012 sticker they never bothered to peel off, right? I think those two groups are probably splitting apart now in the aftermath of the defeats of the last couple of years. And also probably there's been some movement from the first group to the second group, right? Some people, as they kind of realize, in one way or another, right? I mean, it's almost I don't know. I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with a friend of my parents, a guy I've known forever. Me and my dad and my brother went over while I was in Michigan and helped to move some furniture. Then we went upstairs and had a drink, and he was, we're just kind of talking, and he was referring to things that had happened, back in his 20s and he's from Britain, and he was talking about the campaign for nuclear disarmament, actually, I think is the group that he was talking about. I'm not sure, but he wasn't trying to be dramatic or goofy about this. It was just totally in passing without affectation. He said, yeah, back when I thought that anything could change. Right. And he was describing this experience. Right. And I think a lot of people, when they sort of have that feeling that the revolution hasn't happened. Right. And that we're just sort of stuck with what we're stuck with, for a while, in one way or another. I mean, obviously the 1970s version was more dramatic because there were, people who had a feeling that there was more on the table than just let's get some mild social democracy, which was all that we were ever talking about in 2015 and 2020, but we're sort of having a version of it where I think a lot of people are feeling like even that is deferred, for a long time maybe, right? And I think a lot of people conclude a lot of different things from it, but certainly some people, when they decide that's not going to happen, right? I mean, they recalibrate their politics, or people who were maybe always basically, you know, Obama sticker next to the Bernie sticker people, like, mm-hmm. but who were maybe like conjecturally drifted in a better direction, or like sort of pulled back to where they were, right? And they think, you know, and in some ways, I mean, the analogy I used in the article I wrote for Sublation, you know, was obviously to Christopher Hitchens, you know, but I mean, like, in some ways, I think there is a real analogy there that they, you know, that people sort of feel that they're, you know, like, well, okay, we're stuck with this, right? We're just going to accept capitalist realism. So let's at least have some kind of liberal democratic version of that, right? You know, instead of like whatever's represented by like Putinism, and that can, I think it's sort of clear how that can lead people in a bad direction on this stuff, you know, mm-hmm. that, and I would say that there is a sort of core left that has had a much better position. In other words, like, if you think about like the sort of, you know, I don't know, institutions of like, you know, more moderate than Doug Lane, but, you know, but more, but like, of American sort of socialist expression as that have developed since 2015, right? Like, you know, Jacobin, Current Affairs, the DSA even, right? You know,
has Current Affairs been pretty good on this?
Yeah, Current Affairs has been very good on this. If you read, I'll send you some links. You should actually be reading this stuff, because actually, especially right when it all started, the Nathan Robinson wrote a bunch of articles with titles like "Can We Have an Intelligent Adult Conversation About Russia and Taking World War III Seriously?"
Yeah.
And so I think like, yeah, Jacobin and Current Affairs, I think, have both been good on this. I think DSA basically has, although even there, I think that you probably get some version of this split, because like, it's like DSA as an organization, certainly the International Committee of DSA has been very sort of, you know, like, has been very aggressive in taking a you know, peacenik kind of line about this. Although certainly anybody who's like an elected official who's aligned, you know, who's somewhat aligned with it has not, right? I mean, like, this is the, mm-hmm.
Sanders
got the split.
I know before the invasion, Sanders wanted to, I just kind of Googled this while we were talking actually, but Sanders wanted to negotiate before the invasion happened to head off the invasion, and he was much better than Biden on that.
He's largely fallen into line since the So I mean, I wrote an article for Jacobin about this called like, I think it was called like, "We Should Have Listened to Bernie Sanders About Ukraine" or something like that, you know, where like I was sort of bringing back up, because like nobody even remembers this anymore. Yeah.
Right? By the way, Ben, this is something that bugs me now. Okay. I try to find out information about things, and I Google things that I'm interested in, and your fucking articles pop up, and I go, oh, okay, well, Burgess and I know that we're going to mostly agree, and now I want to find, you know, the information. But actually, you're become a pretty good journalist as well as columnist, so I appreciate what you've been doing.
Thanks for that. But yeah, I do. But yeah, I mean, I think Bernie, like, I think that the, I think Bernie's op-ed in the Guardian back in February before the invasion, right? I mean, I remember the timing of this in a weird way, right? Because I think it was literally the. I think the Russian invasion of Ukraine started literally like late the night that I was on Rogan, and before, if not, it was like the next day. Right. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's going to, for better or for worse. Right. You know, that's going to affect how many people pay attention to that, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. the sort of petty thing about me personally. But yeah, I think, but before that, like a couple of weeks before, in early February, Bernie Sanders wrote an op-ed for The Guardian saying the United States should be involved in peace negotiations over the conflict in Ukraine. And I think that was a pretty good article. I mean, I think it was the right line, you know, and And I think that was great. I think he gets a lot of credit for that. What he doesn't get credit for is his positions since it started, which is to say that since it started, he's largely shut up about the whole subject, and he's largely fallen into line as far as voting. I will say I also wrote an article for Current Affairs about this called Congressional Progressives Need to Do Better on Foreign Policy, but that doesn't mean Republicans are doves, where I was sort of trying to simultaneously make the point that that Bernie and the squad shouldn't have voted for all this military aid to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. That at the very least, what I say in the article is they could have, they could have at least said as a precondition, right, for voting for any more, let's at least get Biden to commit to make some effort to pursue peace negotiations. But, obviously they didn't do that. And I think that's a huge, I think that's really bad, right? I don't even want to say it's a mistake, because that makes it sound like it was an accident somehow, right? That this happened. But I mean, I think that was a really unfortunate capitulation, right, to the kind of dominant Democratic Party line on that stuff. I mean, I think the other half of the point of that article was basically a subtweet of Glenn Greenwald, who sort of said, "Oh, now the real anti-war voices are these Republicans who voted against the funding." And I think that's still wrong. I think if you I kind of tried to make the case in the article that if you actually poked into what any of these people think at all, right, about other issues, they're all they're all super terrible, on foreign policy. They're all huge anti-China hawks and all this stuff. But but yeah, I mean,
what was the motivation for them to vote against the aid to Ukraine?
Yeah, well, their stated motivation, at least, was that they what they all said was that it was too much money, and they were objected to it on a spending level. Now you could ask, okay, that's never stopped them before, for any kind of military expenditure. So what's going on there, right? I mean, I think that I think it's a little bit hard to say, because it kills me to say this, the one who is actually the only one, I think the only one of the Republicans who actually mentioned negotiations and what she said about it was Marjorie Taylor Greene, of all people, who's the craziest, person in there possibly. But so I guess some kind of credit to her there. But but I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I think that there's a, there is. I mean, I guess it takes us back to the was Trump a peace candidate question, right? Because I do think the thing that is true is that there's at least a strain of rhetoric in that was introduced by Trump that was, it was always complicated, because he was also saying things in 2016 we should bomb the shit out of them and let's torture the families of terrorists and stuff like that. But
right. No, it was a very weird thing. He was a peace candidate who was absolutely bellicose and threatening. He wanted to steal the oil. Why didn't we just steal the oil? But
exactly. So it was always weird and complicated, but there was an element there, right? I mean, he had he criticized the Iraq war, right, in one of the first debates with Jeb Bush, and pretended that he was always against it, which he wasn't, but whatever, right? He at least pretended. There was this kind of strain of America first, at least gesturing at something like right wing isolation.
Yeah, I mean, it was this sort of isolationist position, which is not necessarily even truly pacifist, right?
Sure.
And it's also not at all the domain of the left exclusively, or even predominantly the kind of
if this is something that's actually going to lead people to oppose wars, that's good,
You work in coalitions, right? I think that the rank and file, including some of the media personalities that are kind of sitting on top of the rank and file, might be more prone to be peace or pacifist or part of a peace movement now of some kind, then the rank and file of the Democratic Party and the media personalities that are providing those consumers with news. I think that the rhetoric and the spectacle around it, around the two parties, is shifting. But I do believe that once either party gets into power, that for the most part, some version of a neocon is going to be running U.S.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, Trump did hire John Bolton, right? That's
right.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's I think the first part of what you just said is less clear to me. I mean, that could be true. I think the evidence is a little bit more mixed, right? You know, in terms of like polls and all that. But maybe, yeah. I mean, I mean, certainly there is some truth to it, because like just in terms of like the popular media personalities, right? I mean, if you're like a, you know, if you're a super fan of Tucker Carlson, you're going to have better foreign policy positions than if you're a super fan of Rachel Maddow. I mean, that's just clearly true.
Right. Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I'm pointing at, you know? Yeah. So which is kind of weird. That's disturbing. Sure. That's not how it was in 2003.
No.
You know?
No, definitely not. No.
So that puts us in a, I think it puts us in a position where we have to not in any way think about embracing Republicans or, but we have to be, we cannot be stopped by those who would say, you sound like Tucker Carlson.
Absolutely not.
You know, Glenn Greenwald now, they'll even say that. Yeah. We can't be stopped in our thinking by those kinds of objections. And we also, I think that we have to abandon the strategy of working with Democrats if we're going to be on the absolute left. Like, we're not going to, for the most part.
What does that mean, though? Like, in practice, what does that mean?
That means that we need to think about, I'm not quite sure in every single, like, let me just think about it for a second, because this is a good sure. question. It means that, obviously, I think the long-term aim will have to be developing an independent socialist party. That in long-term, I mean, in the next 10 years, something like that. And this might be something I'm saying partly out of reaction to the threats that I feel are existential that we're facing. Like, you know, because we can't rely on the slow evolutionary approach to politics happening on a timeline that will stave off some really cataclysmic events, we are forced in a way to try to organize for more radical change through developing an independent party. There's that. And then, other than that, it would mean like we would have to stop even worrying about like which party is the one that we can trust to actually be the peace, to bring forward a peace camp.
Well, I would certainly agree with the second part of that, right? I mean, I absolutely don't think you can trust either one to do that. I mean, I think,
right.
I mean,
it's like saying, let's forget about these particular contingent questions and think about this in terms of the overall trend. And we can see a lot of mostly continuity between the Democrats and the Republicans, especially in terms of foreign policy. And for that reason alone, in a time when we're on the cusp of possibly a world war, there's a need for an independent socialist workers movement and party.
Yeah. I mean, I guess a few thoughts about that.
Take it apart, because, you know, I'm coming up with it, you know, not like completely right now, but.
Sure.
I'm articulating it maybe for one of the first times. So
sure. I mean, I don't know how much I want to take it apart of it. I think that I will also say, right, I mean, I think that sometimes there are, you know, people who who see, like, look, I can give you I mean, whatever, we're talking, right? You know, so just in the spirit of like friends talking, I can give you like my own best guess about what's possible or what might happen or whatever. And I'm very happy to have that discussion, right? But I mean, like, I also think, like, kind of zooming out the lens a little bit, right? I mean, I also think there's a sense in which some people who, you know, who don't like me or, you know, think that they're, you know, sort of think that they're to my left, whatever that means or whatever,
like my son.
Yeah.
He likes you fine, but he definitely thinks he's to the left of you. So yeah, we can use him.
No, I'm really just some tweeting members of the Lane family right now. But I mean, I think sometimes people with that perspective, I feel like, sort of would miss what I would see as the point of a lot of the stuff that I said, right? In other words, like they see me kind of arguing for the stuff that I think that I have a good argument for, or that I think that like I could make some kind of useful intervention on. And then they kind of extrapolate from that, that I must be against anything that goes beyond that. Right. And that's not really right. Right.
I mean, oh, okay. Words, yeah.
Like I think that, you know, it's like, not like I spend my time thinking about like, man, how can I encourage people to support, you know, to support
Bernie Sanders in 2024.
You're not Bernie Sanders in 2024, right? Yeah, exactly. Right. That's like, how could I get people on the left to support Bernie Sanders in 2024? Or, you know, I mean, obviously that's unlikely to happen, but like the sort of broader strategic perspective that might be a stand-in for. Right. And I really don't. Right. I mean, like that's not, I mean, maybe there have been times when I have a little bit, but like that really by and large has not been my focus. Right. I mean, like how could I get people to agree that like what I think is like the sort of most, easy to imagine path forward for the left is like the one that they should be focused on or whatever. I mean, that's not really my interest. Right. I mean, I think as I've seen it, right, since I started doing this stuff in 2018, because of you, right. So I think I want everybody, including members of your family, I hope are really clear that like you're responsible for all this, right? I mean,
I met you and you're a waitress at a cocktail bar.
Exactly. Anything bad that Ben does is ultimately Doug's fault, right? I know.
That's right. And I'm proud to take on that responsibility, Ben.
But
I have utter confidence in you. I have utter confidence in the other Ben that we've been talking about. But,
sure. But like, but since 2018, when I've been doing that stuff, it's like, you know, whatever. Like I have run my mouth about lots of different subjects that have interested me at lots of different times. But I think overall, right, like what's the project been, right? The project has been to do two things, right? One, the primary one is to the kind of stuff that I was mostly doing in the series of videos that I did for Prezura Books, and this kind of stuff I was doing for the debunk segment on TNBS, and the kind of stuff that I do that's like probably still the bread and butter of Give Them an Argument and all the public debates and all that stuff, which is more or less to debunk right-wing ideas, to make arguments for certain kinds of basic socialist ideas, to do all of that. Right. And so the sort of person who all of that is directed to is not somebody who's like a different kind of socialist than I am. Right. You know, that's the person that all that is directed to is to somebody who's just like not on board with any of it. Right. You know, who I think can, you know, I hope can be persuaded. Right. And then the second thing, which was always part of it, you know, I mean, if you read the first book, I mean, this was there, right. You know, but like certainly got much more prominent with the second book is trying to convince my friends and comrades on the left not to do weird, embarrassing shit that makes the first part harder. Right. That's the second part. Right. But I mean, that's like,
that was the part that I was most interested in you doing when I asked you to write, Give Them an Argument. Yeah. Was creating an example for the left on how to and how to think about engaging in politics generally, and mostly with each other. I mean, right. Yeah, with the right, but mostly with each other, that we needed to be able to make arguments and think and steel man each other's arguments and all of that.
Yeah, the two go together in a pretty obvious way, right? I mean, like right. there's the kind of stuff that I really have in mind with number two is less people who like might have a different best guess than I do about like what's a plausible like sort of path forward in terms of like left electoral strategy than like people who, you know, think clapping is problematic and, you know, everybody should, freedom of speech doesn't mean freedom from consequences. And, you know, everybody should devote a lot of time to feeling very guilty about their internalized whiteness and, you know, things like that. Right. So, yeah. So all of that is just to say, right. I mean, like if I remember years ago when we had a similar conversation and I asked you a similar question, like you kind of said something about how you wanted, Chris Smalls, who, by the way, you were the only person who I knew back then who knew that name, but you wanted Chris Smalls to refound the First International. It's like, okay, I mean, if that happens,
that was kind of half delusional, right? But he actually ended up doing much better than many people would have predicted.
Totally. First time I ever heard his name was when he was interviewed on your podcast, you know. So, obviously a half joke here, but it's like, if that happened, yeah, I'm for it. Right. I mean, like if there's a, if we get some sort of like mass wave of, you know, I don't know, like anarcho-syndicalism or like we get, or
as a Marxist, if we get a mass wave of anarcho-syndicalism or whatever, I have to put that down and have them all shot.
Okay. Fair enough. You know, but look, I mean, or if you know, if some of the people that you work with who sometimes frustrate me, like really do get around to forming a revolutionary party, and it's not like 10 people meeting in a back room somewhere, it's like millions of people, then I'll be overjoyed, right? I'll be over the moon, right? You know, they have so that's just like, you know, what I do kind of want to say all that before we get into this, just because I think that both because it's like honest and also just because like, I think that if people kind of don't get where I'm coming from, what my priorities are and aren't, right. You know, like the discussion can read wrong, but like now if we're getting into like, what's my best guess, right. About what, you know, what's like realistically going to happen. I mean, yeah, if there was some sort of mass viable independent workers or socialist party, then that would be wonderful, of course. I think there are, like, depending on exactly what you mean by that, right, there are like these big structural impediments in America's electoral system to like new parties emerging, right? Like that's like a very big problem. Nobody's come up with a great solution to yet. I think that one thing that I do worry about a little bit here is that I think it's very easy for a certain kind of radical to sort of look at failed attempts to do less ambitious things and conclude, oh, there, you know, well, that's clearly a dead end. So therefore we need to just somehow succeed in doing the wildly more ambitious thing, you know, which is like a little bit.
We couldn't figure out how to make a plane that could fly. So clearly we need to get to the moon.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, right. Right. Okay. You know, so, yeah. That's kind of a flawed reasoning. Listen, we're at 52 minutes here. I want to say, I don't need you to go, but what I want you to say is like at 52 minutes, we're going to shift over to the Patreon part of our conversation. And maybe we can pick this up and talk about this. And we've been kind of doing this all along, but and a little bit more personal or practical, immediate terms, like what are we doing in our own projects that we think might have some might need to change or might need to stay the same, or like what, how do I evaluate what I've been doing since, say, let's say, since I started at zero books to now, and how do you evaluate what you've been doing? Because again, like I said at the beginning, I do feel as though I'm at a bit of an impasse and maybe need to rethink what I was doing in order to get to the next stage. So like here, right here, we'll start with the Patreon part of this.